Glenn called in from Salt Lake City, Utah. Glenn, good morning.
Hi, good morning. My question is, since we're spending all this money, where are we getting the money from? And my second question is, if I can itch in your mouth.
I apologize for that, Congressman. Don't take that kind of language here on the Washington Journal. We'll move on.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Television has become so commonplace a part of our life today that we sometimes forget how really new it is. After all, as you recall, it was only at the time of the Kefauver hearings in 1950 that television really began moving up out of the bar rooms and into the family living room. It was just 6 years after the Kefauver hearings in May 1956 that this program, The Open Mind, was born. Since I am a relative newcomer to The Open Mind and had nothing to do with its earlier period, I'm privileged to mention what a breath of fresh air it was in the mass media of that day. It was totally ungimmicked, just four men sitting around a plain wooden table trying to talk sense about something they considered unimportant. It was totally unrehearsed. It was unabashedly intellectual, always preferring the expert and the egghead to the merely glib person. And it was quite adventurous, often venturing into fields and subjects which most of the mass media at that time were shying away from. Well, now The Open Mind is a big boy. It's 4 years old, a ripe old age for a program in a field where obsolescence is so rapid as that of television. And it goes on in its usual way of following its well-established tradition. For maintaining that tradition, for making the continuance of the program possible, for bringing about such a large part of whatever values this program achieves, there are so many people who must be thanked, people that you never see. So many people, and my time here, of course, is so short. Let me cite just two who have been particularly vital. Mr. William N. Davidson, Vice President of NBC and General Manager of WRCA-TV, a strong and consistent friend of The Open Mind, and the producer of this program, Mrs. Eleanor S. Rigger, a young woman of uncommon astuteness, a world of imagination, and a dogged dedication to the highest standards of public affairs programs. Now quickly to the program of today. The moral situation in the United States, the cheating we read about on all sides, and the widespread feeling that we face something of a moral crisis in this country. Our panel, to my right, Mr. A.H. Raskin, whom we regularly read in the New York Times on his labor reporting. In the center, Mr. Reinhold Niebuhr, certainly one of the world's foremost theologians, and also what I would much rather introduce him as, certainly one of America's most beloved figures. And across from me, Mr. William Atwood, foreign affairs editor of Look magazine and the author of an extremely level-headed and penetrating article in Look on the subject under discussion today. May I ask you gentlemen to begin this discussion by a general comment on a quotation from Mr. John Steinbeck. Mr. Steinbeck writing to Adlai Stevenson several months ago. He said, "If I wanted to destroy a nation, I would give it too much, and I would have it on its knees, miserable, greedy, and sick. On all levels today, American society is rigged. I am troubled by the cynical immorality of my country. It cannot survive on this basis."
Feeling a little bit guilty today. Feel like I wasted a lot of water.
You guys know, everybody knows California's in a pretty big drought, but what a lot of people don't know, one of the greatest causes of the drought, almond farming. For every one almond, requires 1.1 gallons of water. Well, this morning I spilled a gallon of almond milk. I did the math, 53,000 gallons of water. I would have saved more water if I threw a pipe bomb into an aquarium. It's not been a good year for me. I don't know if you guys heard, but McDonald's recently decided to stop feeding their chickens antibiotics, which is great news for the chickens. Terrible news for me because I don't have health insurance. You guys, McDonald's chicken meat was my only access to antibiotics. True story, I once cured strep throat with two McChicken sandwiches.
Whoa. I don't feel realistically that we are as sunk in moral degradation as Mr. Steinbeck apparently believes. On the other hand, I do agree that we have a genuine moral crisis in this country, and I think the reason is that we have exalted materialistic goals, and we now live in an era in which we see science reaching forward, racing forward, giving us much greater opportunity for ennobling and enriching life, and at the same time we're oppressed with the sense that science also has made it possible for us to destroy ourselves, and we don't know and we fear that we haven't got the moral wisdom to deal with that problem. Truthfully, I think our social invention has just been left stagnant, and as a result, we really are in a sad condition.
Mr. Niebuhr,
well, I would agree with Mr. Raskin that Mr. Steinbeck's indictment is excessive, but we've got to take it seriously. But I am a little troubled about calling this a moral crisis, because it is a moral crisis, but there's a greater crisis in the political field, in our relationship to the world, for instance, in our relationship to the nuclear dilemma, which has moral overtones. So I'd like to make the distinction of clear moral issues, and I'd say the clear moral issues are where the standards are generally accepted, maybe not practiced, but generally accepted, like honesty and fidelity in marriage, which Mr. Atwood has dealt with in his Look magazine, and the overtones of morality in politics, which is quite different because there you have the ambiguity of the political order, that you don't have a clear goal, but you have several, or not a clear principle, several principles in conflict with each other, and you also have the problem of means and ends. Every political problem is partly a technical problem, partly a moral problem, so that this there may be a greater crisis in this field, but it's not as clear-cut as the moral crisis in the field that Mr. Atwood has been talking about.
Mr. Atwood?
Well, I also agree that John Steinbeck was probably talking more as a dramatist than an objective reporter. I think there has been a change in our moral standards, maybe even a slackening. But the very fact that people are concerned about it and confused about it, perhaps, shows certainly that they're not cynical about it. The very fact that we're sitting here discussing it, and in the course of the survey we made, we found everybody very willing to discuss it. They're upset. I think we have a changing code of ethics in this country. I think possibly something better will come out of it. So we are, in a sense, in a crisis. But it's a crisis of
Well, before we get to that changing code of ethics, I wonder if we don't want to say a word about this distinction which Mr. Niebuhr has made between what might be called political or public morality, the great public questions and their connection with morality, and the more private morality. Are we to assume these two things are separate?
Stephen Hawking is now warning us all that the dangers of thermonuclear warfare, global warming, and genetically engineered viruses means that for the next 100 years we're screwed until we build off-Earth colonies to save our ass. But none of us really, the average person, has absolutely no effect on things like whether or not they decide to drop another atomic bomb or design a genetically engineered virus. That's not really up to us. And he's talking about how further progress in science and technology will create new ways that things can go wrong, as if we're all just sitting around with our science kits in the lab, out in the garage, making this stuff up ourselves. All of the science, all of it, is steered by mega corporate foundations and the military-industrial complex and the government. Period. And that's it. And he's saying that basically we all need to go escape and run off to another planet. That's great. Thank you, Stephen Hawking. I guess I'll just go get in my magic rocket that I built outside.
Stay with that a moment. Are we any worse, at least in the area of public morality, than we ever were? The political instances, bribery was, after all, the standard thing in 1890. It's not now.
The Tweed Gang running
the Tweed
New York
City. Or business practices. Mm-hmm. Adulterating food was standard in 1900. It's not now. Are you quarreling with that approach, Mr. Atwood?
No, I think there's less overt corruption, certainly, in Washington. The favors are not done for bribes, but yeah. I think there's a confusion, certainly there has been, between government officials' sense of public trust and for example, let's take the regulatory commissions. They feel that they should be doing favors for friends. They're not doing it because of any bribe, but it's a failure to understand what public trust is. It's a moral confusion, I think.
But is that new? Isn't it true that in the days of the robber barons, government was regarded as really an agency and a servant of all these trusts that were built up?
Yes, perhaps there's more candor today.
Perhaps there's more concern about things that were much more flagrant in the past. And maybe that's a wholesome rather than a pessimistic development. As you well know, as an old newspaper man, you create a crime wave by writing about it, by talking about it. And it may be that the level of crime is not any greater, and it perhaps is even less.
Well, are you suggesting that we create sin by talking about it?
Well, I think that the extent to which we are concerned about it is a wholesome thing, and that sometimes in our eagerness to do things about problems that are genuine problems, that we create a focus in which it appears that we are suddenly being engulfed by something that has always been with us and perhaps is not nearly as acute as we feel it is.
You know, I feel that I don't want to be complacent by my optimism, but I think Mr. Raskin is right about that. These are the perennial corruptions of power and government, and on the whole, the American government on the federal level, not on the municipal level, on the federal level, with the exception of the Grant administration and the Harding administration, has been fairly good. I think the other point raised in his moral crisis,
yes,
and that is the family, the cheating, the infidelity in family relationship is very much more important than the question of dishonesty, although I agree to his intent.
Let's get to that. Now, you men seem to be agreeing that in the area of public morality, probably either things are pretty much the same or better, or we can't tell anyhow. Let's move to this private area. And, for example, the statements, Mr. Atwood, in that article of yours, where you detect what seems to me rather much a collapse of private morality, a feeling that anything which is not openly illegal and does not directly hurt somebody is okay.
Shoes and money and good friends too.
the field of private morality, what has collapsed vis-a-vis the labor unions?
Well, let me just take the case that Mr. Niebuhr was talking about, the Teamsters.
Yeah.
I think the prevailing attitude that has been demonstrated over and over again of the rank-and-file Teamster is, I don't care what Jimmy Hoffa is accused of doing, as long as I don't see any evidence that he's hurting me. He's delivered for me. My paycheck is good. We've got a good welfare program. We've got a good pension program. This man is doing all right for me. And what do I care what he does? Whose business is it of anybody else? And Jimmy Hoffa approaches his responsibility in that same way. And unfortunately, the employers generally in the trucking industry are perfectly content to do business with Jimmy Hoffa. And employers generally, I find, take the view, well, he was interested in a buck. What's so bad about that? And Walter Reuther, who is certainly, in terms of morality, a much more enlightened person, is the ogre because he's trying to change the basic rules of society.
The basic rules. Yeah. Now, that's what is deficient in just talking about morality, because Hoffa is, presumably, from our position, more immoral, certainly, than Walter Reuther, who is an idealist. But he changes the rules. Now, there you get into political morality.
Yeah.
And the complacency of America doesn't permit that. While it is complacent about the cheating, the dishonesty.
Well, now to take this and to try to move to the question of where we are going with respect to this morals question, Mr. Atwood, you in your article and orally here keep suggesting that the values are changing, particularly in this area of private morality, and you say we're moving toward a group morality. That is, you can do anything that your particular group considers all right. For example, like cheating on the income tax. Now, Mr. Niebuhr, you're our authority on sin here. Is this a morality? Does it make any sense to you?
Well, it makes sense, but I don't think that's new. It's say that a small group has its own standards from the standpoint of which it defies a larger group,
yeah,
whether it be the nation or the community of nations. That's an old thing. I remember that during the war, some very honest Vermont farmers cheated on gasoline because they thought this was Russell's war. And they got away with it because the community agreed with them. That wasn't a private defiance of community standards. It was the community defiance of general standards. That's what we got in the race issue. All this problem of segregation, desegregation, what we've got there is that a small community devoted to the so-called Southern way of life defies the standards, or what we call the standards of humanity, of a common humanity. That's not a new thing. That's an old thing, but it's got a very tragic form now, because the Negroes are on the march and simply insisting on being regarded as human beings.
We begin with the fallout following a racially charged police shooting in Cleveland. It started with a high-speed chase, ended in a hail of bullets. 13 officers fired more than 137 rounds into a car, killing two people inside. They were unharmed. Today, the department issued its findings in the disturbing case. Rochelle Carey has the latest.
But I promised the community at that time that I would find out.
Cleveland's public security director and former chief of police, Michael McGrath, vowed he would get to the bottom of a November 2012 police chase that ended in a barrage of gunfire that killed Timothy Russell and Melissa Williams, both unarmed occupants of this vehicle.
137 shots were fired, involved 60-plus cars, and went through three districts.
On Tuesday, the police department shared its findings, the details of an internal investigation into the actions of 13 police officers involved in the shooting, and announced the firing of six officers, including Michael Brello, the only officer criminally charged in the incident. He was acquitted of manslaughter last May. The acquittal led to demonstrations that were, for the most part, peaceful.
Officer C climbs up on the trunk area of zone car 238.
Brello was accused of standing on a police cruiser and firing 15 shots into the windshield of Russell's car.
Officer C fires into the suspect vehicle.
As part of its internal investigation, police recreated the shooting incident using trial testimony and forensic analysis.
Officer D asks Officer J to retrieve the shotgun from car 217. Officer J refuses due to the gunfire.
Another six officers have been suspended for their role in the pursuit, and a 13th officer will retire early.
It's not criminal, and it doesn't rise to the level of firing anybody.
The police union defended the actions of the officers, who say their lives were threatened when Russell refused to heed warnings.
We fired our guns because they used the car as a deadly weapon, and we have a right to defend ourselves and go home to our families.
The Cleveland Police Union is vowing to appeal the dismissals. Rochelle Carey, Al Jazeera.
Paul Cristallo is a civil rights attorney who represents Timothy Russell's family. He's in Cleveland tonight. Paul, I understand you were meeting with city officials today. What did they tell you?
Well, they told us what the discipline was. It was part of the press conference, and so they laid out the discipline and why they came to those conclusions.
And do you have a sense of why these officers were let go as a result of that conversation?
Well, I think it was a result of just what a complete and utter disaster this pursuit was that ended in the death of two unarmed people. So the six, I guess, worst shooters of the 13 have been terminated.
So as a black man, I'm supposed to be afraid of racist cops walking the street. But if I'm being honest, I'm more afraid of racist lifeguards. I think that's way worse. Because a racist cop has to at least break a sweat, you know? A racist lifeguard just has to not notice you out there. So ask yourselves, is it that black people can't swim, or have we been the victims of a decades-long conspiracy by the aquatic wing of the Ku Klux Klan? That's right. The Klan. By the way, just the Ku Klux Klan should not be the Klan. The Wu-Tang Klan should be the Klan. They've got more members, more number one singles, and according to them, they've killed more niggas.
And rollies, ice chains, and stogies. No bitch can hold me in this dark world. I hold it with the bolo grip, solo controller strip. Behold, PLO the click, man, it's over with so quick. Notice how we bang with the knuckles bare. Turn, keep it fresh like Tupperware. Jungle, animal house, that in your mouth. Probably with the wildlife cannibal out. Give this five course feeling effect. Real a cassette. Or with the mask on, peeling the tech. Killer hell, man, you feeling my set. Feeling my rep. And a man with the top down, wheeling the vet. Scoopy downtown, cop the brand and back to the pit. Twist a blunt in front of Jake and still matching the strip. Stay sick with the rats, it's stacking them chips. In the pit, sick cat packing them grips. Bad bitch with the black tick. After my tits, he like, fish on his hook, and she slash my click. Not a fake, not a fraud. See my name in the war, digging straight like an inmate trying to make the board fake. Playing dude's cake for sure. I lay law, stay raw, cause a massacre with no chainsaw. Half y'all talk about it, but you don't want war. See my wolves eat the bones and we still want more. We be foaming at the mouth even. I doubt we leave without eating, so without reason. Pounds are squeezing, the lifestyle of fiends and beans. Big dreams and cream, bitches ride like the scream machine. For a taste of it, the chicks strip, clean out the jeans. Next thing, she was smuggling coke between.
If real niggas is listening, the life we live in is wrong.
We Wu-Tang is unpredictable. We Wu-Tang is unpredictable.
That's what transitions to save us. We're a race for time. Run the race like a bird. We will lose that mind that we made up.
Kept the weapon concealed like a magician's secret dollar bill. Liable to pull a knife from out of his heel. Snatched the sword from the rock with one hand, one finger.
turn your body to sand. You be hoping you be Spidey to get away from this. You be hoping you be Whitey when the judge get pissed. One man can't uplift the land like Method Man standing on the hands of man. We the captain and lieutenant, true descendant, splendid, unprecedented, hip hop vintage. Started from the park benches before the North the snitches. He was God cipher divine trying to squawk the wizards.
If real is looking distant, the life we live in is wrong. That's what transitions to save us from wrong. We're in a race for time, so we won't lose our mind.
When you won't take it,
but if we run the race like a thug, will we lose that mind that we made up?
Good evening, this is Reba May.
Hey, Reba May, how you doing? I need to make a reservation. I'm going to need about 12 rooms.
12 rooms? You must have a whole lot of people coming.
Oh, yeah, we on tour. We got everybody.
Well, that's fantastic. Who are you with?
The Wu-Tang. We got Method Man, RZA, the Jizza, Old Dirty Bastard, Inspector Deck, You God, Ghostface Killah, Raekwon, the Chef. Everybody's there. You down with this?
Well, I tell you what, sir, I wished I could help you, but I'm not big enough for that.
For 12 rooms?
No, I only have 2 rooms.
I'll take that. That sounds good. Just so long as we can fit the girls in there with us, you know what I'm saying?
Who am I speaking to again?
Huh? Oh, this Shavin. S-H-A-V-I-N, like I'm shaving my face.
Neat. And you're a rock group, or?
Straight hip-hop, yo, from the streets. Hardcore.
Oh,
the real deal weed smokers, you know what I'm saying?
My daughters probably know this. I have a daughter who teaches swing.
She knows Wu-Tang.
Yeah, but first of all, I'm alcohol-free and smoke-free.
No, that's straight, man. We smoke outside.
Okay.
You got turntables and microphones?
I don't have that. I have an old 70s record player.
That'll work.
Okay, where are you performing?
Excuse me, ma'am. Excuse me one second.
No problem.
Yo, shut the f*** up, man. I'm on the motherfucking telephone. All right? Excuse me, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not quite sure that I can totally fit your needs.
Okay, I understand it. But y'all do keep it real over there, right?
You mean like a movie reel?
Yeah, no, like some people is fake.
Y'all
are real, right?
Yeah, you're right. We're not fake. We're real.
No doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You know rap music at all?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I like rap, particularly Christian rap.
Yeah. Word? Yeah, we could do that, too. We do all that. I bust Christian rhymes, whatever you want to hear, just so long as I'm practicing, you know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I understand that.
If you want, I could even write a rap about your bed and breakfast.
That's cool. But I really got to think on this, and unfortunately, I have to leave pretty soon. I have, I'm going to work with some kids, little kids at the church tonight.
Oh, okay. Tell the kids I say God bless. From the Wu-Tang.
Okay.
Yep. I mean, Aunt Reba's B&B. I'm down, it's you and me. All the way from New York to Washington, D.C. to Iowa. All the way I go.
Let me check with my husband and make sure he's willing to give up his bed.
For shizzle, my nizzle.
Okay, and I guess the only concern I have is that we don't want to have some kind of, like I said, a lot of parties and a lot of ladies coming and going.
You want me all to yourself.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right.
I know how it is on Reba. I'm sexy like this.
Okay.
All right, Wu-Tang.
All right, thanks a lot.
All right, peace. I'm out.
Peace. Bye. Neat.
Mr. Atwood, I took you to mean that what is growing up now is a kind of sense, let us say, in the business community, and a sense in the labor community, and a sense in this, that, and the other community, that we have our own rules. This is a little different from the whole Southern group. Was that what you were going to comment
on? Well,
to,
it seems to me that one of the things, first I just wanted to say, to finish out the point that Mr. Atwood and Mr. Niebuhr were discussing, that it seems to me one of the wholesome developments, one of the signs that we are not quite as lost as Mr. Steinbeck professes to feel that we are, is that there is beginning to be an uprising, first of all, led by the Negro students in the South, and having an enormous amount of public support throughout the country. So there is some moral response. But the thing that does disturb me about whether we can really pull out of this or whether we have a group approach, I think that one of the things that's fundamental to our dilemma today is that we have been rooted in the notion that you have to have some kind of financial and material incentives, and that the more and more you pile up a material wealth, this is the better off you will be. And so you find we have the problem of what to do about race relations in the country, what to do about unemployment, what to do about any of these other things that are wrong. And we keep saying to ourselves, not we ought to do these things because they're right, but Khrushchev has threatened that he will do this, yeah, that, and the other, and we must mobilize for this. We are afraid to face up to the fact that we are basically a decent people, that we are concerned about things. We're apologetic about doing the right
people
things.
People are afraid of expressing moral indignation, I think. It's not,
yes,
it's not
it's a great cynicism.
Great tolerance. I think in the unfortunate Van Doren case, this was displayed very well because people sympathized with this fellow. Well, it was entertainment, what would you have done in his position? There seemed to be no thinking beyond all of this to the point of, well, he did lie.
You cite a man, Mr. Atwood, whose group influences were so powerful that he did not cheat on his income tax, but said he did because in his group the mode was to cheat on your income tax. Now where is this decent fellow, though, Mr. Raskin? As you paint him, Mr. Atwood,
well,
he cheats in school while he's growing up, he cheers Charlie Van Doren, then he cheats on his expense account, and et cetera, all the way through.
Well, I think it would be fatuous to pretend that we don't have these tendencies and that they are enormously widespread. And I think the disturbing thing is that too much now the pressure of the community is to identify with this as the right thing to do, so that we feel, well, it's a sucker, you're being naive, being stupid. It's just not the thing to do to say, I believe in what's right and decent, and I practice. You begin to feel it's sanctimonious and
well, to some degree, this is a perennial problem, that there is a group pressure and that creates standards. On the other hand, thank goodness, there are individuals who defy their group for the sake of honesty, etc. I remember a pre-war British ambassador, whose name I've forgotten, making a point about this. He said, I've served His Majesty's government through all cultures and climes, with all kinds of standards, but I found one significant uniformity in all of them, and that is that they all distinguish between an honest and a dishonest man.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, let's get ready to rumble!
Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump now says he will skip the Fox News Google debate. Welcome to the Kelly File, everyone. I'm Megyn Kelly. The news breaking just a short time ago during a press conference in Iowa, where our own Carl Cameron was standing by, and he spoke directly to Team Trump afterwards. We'll go to Carl in a moment. But first, this controversy dates back to August 6th, and the very first Republican debate co-moderated by yours truly. Mr. Trump took issue with this question that I posed to him. Mr. Trump. One of the things people love about you is you speak your mind and you don't use a politician's filter. However, that is not without its downsides, in particular when it comes to women. You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account...
Only Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account...
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
I remember when we broke up the first time, saying this is it, I've had enough. 'Cause like we hadn't seen each other in a month, when you said you needed space.
What?
Then you come around again and say, baby, I miss you and I swear I'm gonna change. Trust me, remember how that lasted for a day. I say, I hate you, we break up, you call me, I love you.
In the months since, Mr. Trump has repeatedly brought up that exchange as evidence of alleged bias on my part. I maintain it was a tough but fair question, and we agreed to disagree. This past weekend, Mr. Trump resumed his complaints about yours truly, arguing that Fox News chief Roger Ailes should ban me from the debate this Thursday. Fox News had announced back in August that Bret Baier, Chris Wallace, and I would be the moderators of this next debate. Mr. Trump's complaints continued through the week, ultimately resulting in a video today he posted to Instagram hitting this issue again. Fox News responded, and we'll get to all of that in a moment. As the front runner, he was scheduled to be front and center on Thursday night when Fox News hosts the Republican debate in Iowa. Now he says he will not show.
Ooh, 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 we called it off again last night, but ooh, 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 this time I'm telling you, we never, ever, ever getting back together. No, we are never, ever, ever back together. You go talk to your friends, talk to my friends, talk to me, but we are never, ever, ever, ever getting back together.
I'm really gonna miss you picking fights, and me falling for it, screaming that I'm right, and you would hide away and find your peace of mind with some indie record that's much cooler than mine.
Senator Cruz, before we get to the issues, let's address the elephant not in the room tonight. Donald Trump has chosen not to attend this evening's presidential debate. What message do you think that sends to the voters of Iowa?
Let me say, I'm a maniac, and everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way... I want to thank everyone here for showing the men and women of Iowa the respect to show up and make the case to the people of this state and the people of the country why each of us believe we would make the best commander-in-chief. That the last four questions have been, Rand, please attack Ted. Marco, please attack Ted. Chris, please attack Ted. Jeb, please attack Ted. Let me just say this.
It is a debate, sir.
Well, no. A debate actually is a policy issue. But I will say this. Gosh, if you guys say ask one more mean question, I may have to leave the stage.
I used to think.
He calls me up and he's like, I can't believe you're working with Jake.
I know, like all he does is whine about his YouTube comments. We are never working together again. Like ever.
No! We never, ever, ever getting back together. We never, ever, ever getting back together. You go talk to your friends, talk to my friends, talk to me. Getting back together.
News, it came out recently that Donald Trump speaks to the voting populace at a whopping fourth grade level. Literally, the lowest of all the presidential contenders. I'm sorry, let me rephrase that for any Trump fans out there. Trump talkie like a little baby boy. Oochie goo goo goo. And if any Trump supporters out there still don't understand what I'm saying, could you just go back to your coloring books for like a few minutes and let the grown-ups talk? Could you do that? Yes, a fourth grade level. You've heard the quote, if you put an infinite number of monkeys at an infinite number of typewriters, one would write Shakespeare. Well, for a Trump speech, it would take three monkeys. One to type, two to throw their poop. Here's a real quote from a Donald Trump speech. This is just an average quote. Now we have to build a fence, and it's got to be a beauty. Who can build better than Trump? I build. It's what I do. I build. I build nice fences, but I build great buildings. Fences are easy, believe me. He sounds like Huckleberry Finn after spending 20 years in the NFL. It's like a load of concussions. In Trump's defense, later in that same speech, he did use some four-syllable words, like some kind of elitist show-off. He said, our president is either grossly incompetent, a word that more and more people are using, and I think I was the first to use it. Yes, after saying incompetent, he felt the need to brag about using such a big word. Then claimed he's the first one to have figured out how to use it. Like it's f***ing Excalibur, and he just pulled it out of the stone. He's holding the word incompetent over his head and going, by the power of numbskull, I have the power! But it gets better. Most of these simple words Trump is using are not even true. According to the nonpartisan organization PolitiFact, a whopping 76% of the statements by Trump were judged to be mostly false, or pants on fire. That's a real category for them. So Trump is no average fourth grader. He's a dumb, lying fourth grader. He's like the fourth grader who kept calling the teacher mommy. And she had to be like, I'm not your mommy, all right? If you've glued your fingers in your nose again, Donnie, you have to deal with it yourself. That's Donald Trump. To give you a little perspective, Bernie Sanders speaks to voters at a 10th grade level, and George Washington's farewell speech was written at a graduate level. However, when spoken through his hippo bone teeth, it sounded like this. Wah, 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 wah. Long story short, Donald Trump is no George Washington. He's closer to George the Animal Steel, a professional wrestler who ate the turnbuckles. Trump is doing the presidential candidate equivalent of eating the fucking turnbuckles. And this is significant because it represents the continued dumbing down of America. Much like the award-winning porn, Butts of Thunder, we're involved in an extreme race to the bottom.
Don't.
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
We circle round and round. No anecdote could convey the aspirations in my throat. So from my mouth you will not hear a sound. Please let the drawbridge down. I'm not the one that you can claim as one who's become blissful and estranged, cause underneath the sun we're all the same, and underneath the moon we're much more fun. These castle walls have held steadfast before me all the while. The window is an affectatious smile that beckons me inside. I've been disarmed by the promise of these open blanket arms that as we sail along will guide us out of harm and roll us in their tides. I'm not the one that you can claim as one who's become blissful and estranged, cause underneath the sun we're all the same, and underneath the moon we're much more fun.
Now, go find the others. .com.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, 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 click. It's real easy, man.
Neat.